The first lesson today is from the fourth chapter of Mark. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great gale arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already being swamped. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased, and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The second lesson for today is from the 38th chapter of Job. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid the cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, 'Thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stopped.'" This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. One commentary I consulted early in the week on the Job passage gave this advice. Under no circumstances should the preacher illuminate this text with a story or pithy illustration in which everything magically turns out all right. Really? Okay. I wonder how much that commentator got paid to make that insight, because I don't think I know very many stories in the Bible where everything magically turns out all right. And very least of all, Job. There's very little in Job that we can turn to for upbeat, feel-good, shiny, happy, clappy theology, is there? Early in my ministry, I was explaining to my daughter and her friend that Job was a story that I would be preaching about that week, because, you know, these stories come around every 3 years. And even those two, who had had up to that point a rather sheltered life, knew about Job. To quote my daughter's friend, this is a direct quote, "Whoa, Job? His life sucked." Indeed. The first 37 chapters of the book of Job describe in vivid detail all the trials and travails of Job's rather stinky life, beginning with when things were good, and from there was really nowhere to go but down. And when things are on the downward spiral, there's only one question to ask: why? In Job's immediate social circle, there were plenty of people willing to either ask or discuss why things were going as they were. You've heard of Job's famous three friends, perhaps, who might as well be called the Three Stooges for all the wisdom they are able to impart on the situation. Larry, Moe, and Curly, also known as Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, seem like they have all the answers. Even Job's pitiful harpy of a wife makes a brief appearance, encouraging her husband to curse God and die. It seems as though only Job's friend Elihu is willing to cut God a break and remind Job of God's omnipotence, power, and might. And I just gave you the first 37 chapters of the book of Job right there. Finally, God speaks. And we hear God not answering the question why at all, but saying loud and clear, who? Who laid the foundations of the earth? God did. Who determined night and day and sea and sand? Who decided that clouds would be in the sky and grass beneath our feet and not the other way around? Who decided that the beluga whale and the amoeba would inhabit the same earth? God did. God made those things completely without our input, and it helps us to remember that we were not there when they were created. Years ago, I was at a final recital my daughter had at White House of Music. She had been taking regular guitar lessons there, and she and some friends had formed a girl band. They called it an angry girl band. I said, "What makes your band so angry?" "That we can't afford good instruments, Mom. That makes us an angry girl band." So when we arrived, we found out that many of the music teachers at White House were having their students perform. So we were treated to a lot of different musical styles and instruments that evening. One performance was especially memorable, besides my daughter's, I mean. So a young musician, probably 12 or 13 years old, performed a snare drum solo. Just a boy, two sticks, and a snare drum. His teacher introduced him with great pride, letting us know that we were in for a great treat. The performance had earned the student a very high rating at the state solo and ensemble contest. I'm not really well versed in my percussion, so I wasn't sure what to expect. Thankfully, we had no percussionist in my household. Then this quiet, unassuming young boy stepped up and began to drum. And as he did, everyone in the room was riveted to what he was doing. He seemed to be moving the drumsticks faster than the speed of light or sound, although I know technically that's not possible. Faster and faster he went as the rhythms got more and more complicated. Before I knew it, he was actually playing both ends of each stick, flipping his wrist faster than I thought was humanly possible. I mean, I can't even show you. It was that good. And it wasn't just rhythmic pounding. He was making music. Suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed two young girls sitting in the row in front of me, little girls, no older than 5 or 6. And they seemed to be laughing and giggling at something, but I couldn't imagine what. Then I noticed they were doing this funny movement with their heads and just having a blast with each other about something. And I followed their line of sight, and I saw that they were reacting to what the drummer's teacher was doing. He was seated in the front row right next to his student, and his eyes were closed, and he had his big grin on his face, and he was moving his head in time to the drum beat. The message that his face and body were giving off were pure delight. Delight in his student, delight in the gift of music, delight in the art of teaching. And the girls were not really listening to the music. They were riffing off of this teacher's happiness. And I had gotten caught up in watching them. I was actually in that moment about 3 steps away from what was happening in the room. I was watching them. They were watching the teacher. The teacher was actually listening to the music. We all do this in our daily life. We get distracted and we wander and we end up 3 steps removed from what God is doing, from what the Spirit is saying, from where Christ is leading us. Which is not to say that our being distracted is what causes bad things to happen to us. but it might prevent us from asking the right questions when we are trying to figure out how we ended up in dire straits, or what we're supposed to learn from our hardships, or how we are simply to cope. Job's friends weren't just giving the wrong answers, they were asking the wrong questions. God is not a why. God is a who. And just who or what is bigger than God? That is the question God is asking Job. And God, just like lawyers and middle school principals, never asks a question to which God does not already know the answer. And in the asking, God pulls Job and us back to the point, back to the place where God's joy and delight and power and creativity live. And for every question of why the universe acts as it does, God comes back with the same counter question: who loves you? The story of Job becomes not just a cautionary tale or an object lesson in human suffering, but a testimony of God's immense love for all of creation. Job's friends approach the situation like litigators, and God responds with poetry. Here again. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place, so that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal. It is dyed like a garment. Light is withheld from the wicked, and their uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare, if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern its path to its home? Surely you know then, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Have you entered the storehouses of snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? This continuation of God's poetry is big, expansive language. And even big language is not enough to express God in all of God's creative majesty. And in our self-centered way of perceiving big language, we are tempted to think that such big language is intended to make us feel small. And in some ways we are smaller than God, of course, but not insignificant. It does not make us bigger to deny God's immensity, and it does not make God bigger for us to play small. And if we give God the credit for who God is, it puts the rest of our universe in the proper proportion. Without it, we fall victim to the most insidious form of idolatry: imagining all the things that we think are more important than God. I've done it. You probably have too. At some point, you've had a fear that you thought was more powerful than God. You lost your job and worried that unemployment was more powerful than God. You got caught up in a terrible relationship, left that relationship, and then worried that being alone was more powerful than God. You got in credit card debt and thought that Visa was more important than God. Your dream did not turn out the right way, and you thought the circumstances were more powerful than God. You got a terrible diagnosis and worried that cancer, diabetes, emphysema, arthritis were more powerful than God. You watch somebody you love suffer consequences of bad choices and worried that bad luck was more powerful than God. Loss and fear and worry and sickness and loneliness are sometimes bigger than we are. Remember, I promise no stories where everything magically turns out all right. But they are never bigger or more powerful than God. And sometimes the way that we can cope and even hope when things seem overwhelming is to rest in the promise of God, the who that is bigger than the why we can ever imagine, and to lean into the one who welcomes us with open, creative, loving, powerful arms. Thanks be to God. Amen. Mm-hmm.